This is WCNO Palm City, the good news station.
It's a new day, and I'm Rhett Palmer. I'm seated here with Jason Conklin. How you doing, Jason?
Good, how are you?
Good. I need you to lean in as close as you can to me. My arm's going to get worn out by the time this interview is over. Now, you were in the military. You were in the Coast Guard for
10 years.
10 years, and where were you educated?
Everywhere. So, let's see. That's a loaded question. You mean as far as college goes? I got my bachelor's from Metro State University in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And what was that degree in?
Biosphere sustainability and human interoperability.
Okay, and so you left the military and started your own company called Argo. What does Argo do?
Argo Sciences is a research and development firm based focused on environmental development.
Okay, now what's this missionary work that you do?
My wife and I served as missionaries in the past. We both I've been to Zimbabwe. Kate's been to Ukraine, and we've done Ukraine together as a husband wife team. And we started Theos Kelly Group, which has two divisions. One's WhenGodCalls.org is the main brand name, and the purpose of that was to facilitate our mission work as we go to different places around the world doing church development, church planting, and then community development and transformation.
Okay, so under what auspices do you do that? Under the authority of a certain congregation or group, or just yourself?
A combination of each area of focus has a different church or organization that we work with. So E3 Partners is in charge of Zimbabwe. We went through Calvary Chapel to do the Ukraine. And then we also work in the academic side. We work with a gentleman, Kevin Bywater, at the University of Oxford, who handles all of the worldview courses that are available there that we work, and we kind of facilitate all of those things going, working together at different times.
Now, you know, I told you I went to Zimbabwe years ago. Zambia's there, and I did a concert in Zimbabwe. And I was telling you about Victoria Falls and the glory of it. Well, you showed me a photo yesterday. It's entirely dried up. It's just the Victoria Canyon now.
Yeah, disappointingly, there is a dry and wet season, so they can be somewhat exaggerated, but they've had a major drought over this last couple of years. It's actually the growing season's much limited, and they've also had power rations where they only get 3 to 4 hours of power per day, and that's because they're hydroelectric off of the Zambezi River. So that's been a real hampering thing, issue with them.
I was there over 30 years ago. When did you go?
Last time I was there was 2019. Most recently was the last trip we made.
Okay, Mugabe was no longer president then.
I think he had just
stepped down.
Just stepped down, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, so what were you doing in Zimbabwe? I was there to put on a concert. I've been to Haiti and food drives, but what did you do in Zimbabwe?
So main focus is community transformation, and what that means is we basically we work with the local church, and it's actually just we're basically augmenting them and their goals. We don't want to impede on the culture of the indigenous people. We want to make sure that we're helping them reach people, and that's and supporting what exactly they're trying to accomplish. And that means in community development is where you have these neighborhoods and everything. Then we try to plant local congregations, get a local place for them to meet, set up either whether it be a tent or even if some people will volunteer their home. In some cases, they have the resources to get a building, and where they can where the community can get together and meet. And then we try to raise awareness so that the communities are actually a little more bonded, so you have a much more stable social structure for people.
Stepping on the culture, you mentioned the culture. I was just thinking, for a long time, in the arrogance of many people, we'd come into a country, Christian missionaries, and step on the culture. How do you minister Jesus without stepping on the culture?
Respect of what, so their culture persuasions are not necessarily in conflict. We make sure we go in there preaching the gospel and not Western civilization. So I mean, we're not there to
broad preaching Western civilization. Very well said. Yeah.
They're trying to make sure that we respect their styles of music, for example, their methods of worship. So the dancing that they like to do, very very rhythmic people. And then also being, mindful of customs and cultures that would be somewhat perceived as possibly even pagan to us, or to those, to some of the more Orthodox Christians. So that's a very important thing that we respect and don't impede on those things. So we're trying to make sure that they don't feel a threat. We're received as the love of Christ can be shown, and how you go about worshiping is indigenous to your own people.
Yes, some of my friends that have a lineage from Africa, black friends in America today, You know, I don't know if you've gone to a black church. I know that you two spent some time up in the Carolinas. I remember finding myself in, it was either Darlington or Florence one time, and I was up on the stage performing when I suddenly realized I was the only blanc in the audio, in the room. I was the only white guy. But I noticed one thing about, and I've asked my black friends, my quote-unquote African-American friends, you know, what is this, the cultural difference? Because a friend of mine who is a lot smarter than me, black man or African-American, learned, very highly learned academic, a doctor, medical doctor, and, you know, even when I went to his church with his wife, it's like they go on for hours and hours, and I tried them to explain. Well, I guess it becomes an event. I don't know if it's from the history of being a slave, and then on Sundays, the longer you stayed, I guess, in the church service, the more time you had together to socialize, because during the week you weren't allowed that socialization. I don't know what's caused that. Yeah, but I noticed in Africa, too, they have pretty long services there. I mean, the girls would get up and sing with their tambourines, and this was done for, you know, a good 45 minutes of one song.
That's yes, par for the course. I mean, there's no a structured, regimented service for like 1 hour on a Sunday. That's got a certain, you know, length of time and everything. That's Western civilization. That's purely a Western work ethic of thinking. So and that's something that doesn't really apply. That's not where they came from. So to them, when they're going to worship on Sunday, first of all, they're happy to worship any day. They're happy to sing and dance and in just after, before, during Bible study. And there is no, they're going to meet at a Bible study on Tuesday night at 6 o'clock. It's customary to show up at 6:30 or 7 o'clock. That's fine, but it's also customary to expect to be there till midnight or 1 a.m. They're happy to do so. If the spirit is leading, they just go with it, you know, and then just have a good time. It's really about, you know, if there's no regimented set period of time per se, other than the fact that you get tired, of course. But
I noticed one thing, like when I was in Haiti, that where they're very desperately poor. I mean, Zimbabwe was a prerequisite for going to Haiti for me. I was in a culture shock in Africa, in Zimbabwe, and I was scared to death. But when I went to Haiti and saw the way the people are living in Africa, that they're affluent compared to Haiti. Mm-hmm. But I noticed the faces running up to me in a field of the people that were poor, but they were so happy because they said, here comes a Christmas gift that I get to unwrap, another human being to get to know. Their joy and their wealth is in their fellow human beings, not in the acquisition of stuff, because there's no stuff to be gotten, you know?
I was extremely moved by the, I noticed, you're correct, and even in Zimbabwe, they do have social media, they do have smartphones, they do have Facebook and all that, but most of them really couldn't care less about it. It's nowhere near the level of
addiction,
time consumption that it is. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple reasons why I believe that is. Number one, they don't have unlimited data. You pay by the megabyte.
That's a good point. Yeah. They don't have unlimited data.
Well, that's whereas we're used to phones having some crazy amount of bandwidth. Yeah. So they're very careful of what they spend their time looking at because it costs money. And then number two, the quality of life is more built on community. So I mean, it's in who they know and, you know, what kind of time they spend together. And you've noticed very rarely does someone eat alone. And matter of fact, I never saw anybody eat alone. Even people that were, you know, broken homes or families were incomplete. There was a community gathering. Everyone, it was a customary to have a meal, no matter whether it be breakfast, lunch, or supper. Even the whole gaggle was there. One of the neighbors was over with their family. There was always some kind of community around.
It's a good excuse to get together. Let me ask you this. I want the short version, and then we can do the longer version. How did you, at what age did you come to know the Lord?
Well, I was in 1999, so that would have been, I was 22 years old.
22 years of age. Now, so you're pretty set in your ways by the time you're 22. What amazes me, but how did you come to know the Lord? What did you 2 years? You were Catholic, were you a Presbyterian? What were you growing up, or were you anything?
So I was raised Roman Catholic. I was, you know, went through my Blessed Sacraments, Holy Communion, Confirmation, all of the rules and rituals that we're culturally prone to do. So, and then I also went to Catholic school. So I was very well, you know, versed in the church and in the gospel. I had never heard the term relationship until I was in my early 20s. And the first time I heard it, I thought it was, you know, silly or ridiculous or preposterous. I thought, who the heck does that? You're smoking relation, or you're on something. I didn't understand what that meant. And what sounded like a cult or something like that.
Yeah.
So how do you have a relationship with Jesus?
Yeah. That sounds... A real relationship? No. Well, we want the perfunctory duty of showing up in the pageantry, right?
Right. I mean, but there was something to be said for that. I mean, I did enjoy a lot of things about church, but I realized part of the reason I got disenfranchised and frustrated was because I was going through motions and rituals and not actually having relationship.
Okay, so what caused you to call upon the name of Jesus and be what they say born again?
My office manager at the time, I had a business down in Virginia. I was in Portsmouth, Virginia, and I remember my office manager invited me to his church service, which I had, and I said, so they met in a high school, and I thought, well, how does a church meet in a high school? And of course, they had guitars and band and drums and all this
now
stuff.
Now, why did you go? Because he was in your authority? You thought, well, you wanted to appease him and build the relationship, or was there a desire or a hunger, a thirst from you?
There was a desire and a hunger and a thirst, yes. I had my own business there for, at that point, coming up on 2 years. I was out on my own finally, early part of life, and I was very unfulfilled and very, very, I just felt a certain emptiness. Something was missing, and I wanted to understand more, and I just didn't quite understand. You know, friends were shallow and superficial. Nothing was really of any quality or substance, so I knew something was missing.
How did it come that he invited you?
Let's see. We just had a conversation one Saturday, or one weekday morning, I should say. It wasn't Saturday. We were just having, I forget how it came up in conversation, but he just invited me to come with him.
Cool.
And I went.
What kind of a church was it? Not non-denom, did you say?
Right. It was a Western Branch Community Church at the time.
All right. So what happens? You walk through the door. Does the wall fall in?
Yeah, the wall didn't fall in. I didn't light on fire, and none of that happened, you know. But the first thing I listened to the sermon. The first thing I noticed, this was the first time I heard scripture being read and applied to real life. And actually, and then every time I had a challenge or a question or something that didn't make sense to me or something I wanted to argue with, the Jim Wall just kept on answering it. As if he could hear me asking these questions, and he would just address every single one, boom, 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 and it was all based on just pure scripture.
This must have been very good for you, because you're more of an, I think you pride yourself on being an academic. You have a great command of the English language. You like to study, a bio something or other?
A scientist, I guess, would be the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Research scientist would be the main umbrella term, if you want to call it that. So yes, I'm extremely learned. I don't just take things at face value. So, and especially when a preacher could sit there and speak to me like that.
Uh-huh. You must have been really intrigued.
Very. They got me to go back a second time, a third time. I couldn't stop.
Really?
I just couldn't stop going. I'm like, okay, I've got to hear this again. Something's I've been missing this all along.
Yeah.
And when I heard that, and then there's a flip side of that, caveat number two. No one was superficial at this church. These were genuine people who were genuinely interested in meeting me. When I came back, they remembered my name, welcomed. Some of them gave me a hug, said, hey, good to have you again, and let's go get some coffee or something like that. There was actually a social sphere of element that just had there was a fellowship that had a level of bonding to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that just really floored me, because most church relationships tend to be very superficial in a regimented, a structure of mass versus this was completely built on relationships. And I thought, okay, this is different.
Mm.
But that was my first encounter with realizing just how fattening being distant can be, because everything's around food. So, but that was the great part. We never went hungry. There was always for a bachelor, somebody cooked. It was great, and the fact that they had facilitated community groups and that met together for 20-somethings, college-age kids. That was perfect for that. So the community building was a huge part.
So you're going to this church on Sundays. You're suddenly have this hunger and thirst for the Word of God, and what happens next?
Once I understood everything, it was September of 2000. I got baptized, because it was at that point it was all in. I knew it was the right thing to do.
So you wanted to make a public display of your faith?
Yes. Yeah, at that point I was committed. I knew it was the right thing to do. I knew I was seeking this all along. Finally found it. I found what Christ really is, what he's about, what he's all about, and then how to be connected to him.
So was it by intellect, or was there a point? In other words, for me, I didn't believe in Jesus. Thought it was a bunch of hogwash. Even though my grandmother and my mother before me were Catholics, I'm 29 years of age. Suddenly, I call out to him. I have a miraculous encounter, and I know that the light has the switch has been turned, and I went from darkness to light. And it's hard to explain that. Was there a point? Okay, you accepted him religiously or intellectually? Was there a time where it went into your belly, your heart? I guess you call it a born again experience.
Yes, and I want to say there's an exact specific pivotal moment. I couldn't narrow that down. I think once the seed was planted, it was one of those that wouldn't stop growing. Mm-hmm. And if I ever deprived it of water, it was thirsty and it would let me know. There was something at that point that I just could not get away from anymore, because I knew that there was something solid here. And I would get, and I can't really say there's a one specific element. I knew the life without it was absolutely not an option. I didn't want it anymore because it was empty.
Wow. So you come to know Jesus at the age of 22. Are you in the military at this time, or are you still in college?
I hadn't gone back to school yet either. I had my first business, first company down in Virginia, in Norfolk area.
So were you one of these guys that went to high school, then took time off, and went back to college later?
Many times, yes. So I came out of high school, went to Penn State, got a job at a computer store. Then I went up to work for a software company. I had gone over to Moravian College doing computer science. I hated Penn State. I didn't like what I was learning. It was a waste of time.
What were you studying?
Pre-law.
Okay.
And I realized it was not what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. You know, the O.J. Simpson trial was going on my freshman year and all that. Mm. So
which trial?
O.J. Simpson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I went to work for a software company up in Pennsylvania, and then started my own business in 1998. And had that for 2 years. Sold that in 2000. Went to work for Adobe for 2 years, and then I concluded at Adobe. Yes, I wanted to go back to college and do something I actually wanted to learn. And at that point, I knew the Lord. And I knew, and I started praying about, you know, different directions, what I could do, where I could go. Always loved the ocean, which has a funny story, but I loved the ocean, joined the Coast Guard, and wound up in Colorado where I met Kate. Yeah.
So that's the funny story?
Yeah, it's the fact that I joined the Coast Guard and wound up in Colorado a million miles from any ocean or beach or anything like that.
How does that happen? Now, after the fact, or you were in the Coast Guard in Colorado?
I was in the Coast Guard station in Colorado.
Why do they have a Coast Guard station in Colorado? Your wife's on the other side of the room laughing hilariously.
Yeah, that's, when you're part of the...
When you're part of the American military, you never know, right?
Right. I mean, you know, I never thought I was going to see Germany. I never thought I was going to see Eastern Europe. I was never by the water. I never thought I'd be in the Pentagon either, but things, you know, things happen.
You're in the Coast Guard, and you never got to be on the water.
No. Oh, well, when I was on leave, I was. You know, if I took some leave and went on vacation.
No, that doesn't count. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree. I have more time on the bass boat than I do. So, yeah, I'd never gone underway or anything like that. It was part of a combination of things.
I was pitching all this time with the captain's hat on and chugging along the, you know, the rivers and, you know.
Well, this, you know, to count the St. Croix, well, like I said, when I was out fishing on leave, then so be it, between Minnesota and Wisconsin. That's the closest I got. So we, it's interesting how I wound up out there. But, you know, it had to do with just my specialty. I had a very unique assignment, and I had also a unique set of skills. So I went as a marine science technician, which primarily focused on hazardous material response. And I was on a hazmat team, but then I'd gone to weather school.
What's hazmat mean?
Hazardous materials.
Oh, okay.
Hazmat. So, like, yeah, we, the Coast Guard would clean up, we would supervise either oil spill cleanup or any kind of discharge in the ocean that could be of a hazard to navigation or people, or there's all sorts of things that can happen with it. But my area of specialty was in meteorology. So I went to weather school down at Mississippi at Keesler Air Force Base for a year. Then I went to do climatology and analyzing the polar ice caps. And we used the same, the reason the tie over to intelligence happened was because we used the same satellites for the reconnaissance that we do for weather. And that's how I wound up in Colorado, because it was such a specialized thing. So
I'm still laughing with your wife over here. I never heard of a guy that was in the Coast Guard that never got to be on the water.
What
the heck are they doing in Colorado?
Yeah, I think the majority, we have like, the Coast Guard only has a few hundred rescue swimmers. The rest of them are all on land. They're all land-based. Now, usually along the coast, but, you know, not in my case. I was kind of a fish out of water, literally.
Have you been down to the UDT Seal Museum? It's only about 12 minutes from here in Fort Pierce, Florida. That is the Seal Museum.
I have not been there, no.
Oh, you'll love that, I think.
I should go check it out.
You and your wife need to take a trip down there. Okay, so where are we going next with this? Because, you know, I want to find out more about your walk with the Lord. So you're in college, and then you join.
We kind of skipped a couple of elements, but
okay. So what did we skip?
Well, while I was at Adobe, I was praying about direction, you know, and all that, and trying to go back to college. And I wanted to go back to school for something that I wanted to learn. I fell into computers, and I had, you know, was pursuing pre-law because my mother said I had to do something that made a lot of money. That was a mistake. She was just pursued my heart at the time anyway. It was a waste of time.
That's a big lesson. A lot of people don't follow the money. The money will follow the ministry.
That's true. You know, I actually look at when I was happiest was not necessarily my wallet was the fattest. It was when I was the most stable and fulfilled. Because, you know, like I say, if you enjoy what you do, you never work a day in your life. While I was at Adobe, and I started praying, my cousin I was living with at the time, he was in the Coast Guard, and he said, let me go check out, they have, you know, join the reserves at least, just that way you can go back to school and get it paid for, and then they offer, you know, there's all these benefits they have, and they also have a marine science program. So I look into it, and then I was like, okay, well, this is, I never would in a million years considered the military before, so I thought, okay, well, let's try something different. And I thought, what's the Coast Guard? It can't be that hard. That was wrong. That was the wrong attitude to think right there. And so I go down to the recruiter, and the recruiter looks at me and he goes, oh, he goes, well, yeah, we have this, but you got to lose 68 pounds. He says, you can't join the Coast Guard. And I'm like, you know, I can't.
68, that's quite a bit.
It was a significant amount. I've been overweight my entire life at that point. And I'm, don't tell me what I can't do. Who the hell are you? Pardon my language. Who do you think you are? And I thought to myself, this guy just insulted living daylights out of me. And this is how you know something's from the Lord, because it doesn't go away. And that's what I originally kind of dismissed it. But when the guy says, oh, you can't. I'm like, I'll show you what
your feathers got raised up.
Oh, just a bit. I said, I'll show you what I can and can't do.
Yeah. So what happens?
So I went on the Atkins diet. Well, I went to see my doctor first and found out all, you know, because I'd always been over a little chubby. And I said, well, I feel better. And at that point, I was already running every day, too. I still was pretty active. And
just for people that don't know, I had Dr. Atkins on my show, obviously, when he was alive. And it's a high-protein, low-carb, low-sugar diet, correct?
Yeah. Well, if you had been, in my case, I didn't realize a lot of stuff that I thought was healthy was actually fattening. And so I'd lost all this weight. I walked back in the recruiter 4 months later. He didn't recognize me.
68 pounds lighter?
Yeah, in 4 months. And then he didn't recognize me.
68 pounds in 4 months?
Yeah. I did it.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it was a pretty aggressive. And he's like, can I help you? And I said, well, I've lost the weight. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, you told me I had to lose 68 pounds. And he looked at me and he couldn't quite remember. And then he found my paperwork. He goes, oh. He goes, oh, wow. Yeah, I'll show you. Wow. Yeah. Now you want to talk seriously now about this? Am I worthy of your of entry to the Coast Guard? At the time, that drive, it was to the point that no one would even go out to eat with me anymore. Because of the food I would order was the most off the wall stuff on the menu. Well, like no carb. So I'd get the steak, and I'd have them hold the mashed potatoes and switch it to mashed cauliflower, and I'd have them, you know, give me the cheese, but I can't have the no carrots. And I start plucking random things out of my meal, to the point that the waiter's kind of getting annoyed, writing, you know, okay, what am I trying to add to this? Because I could just have, you know.
But let me ask you this: when you go through the desert of no carbs. I had a friend of mine, he lost 60-plus pounds on Atkins. When you went off it, he gained the 60 back and an additional 20. Because then the body's going, hey, we got to make reserves next time. This guy might go through the desert of no carbs again.
Well, first mistake is you don't go back to doing what you did before if it didn't work. I kept it off for almost 10 years. So the only time I started weight started creeping back on for me was when I got injured. So
how did you get injured?
I ruptured a disc in my back in 2007. And then I had torn rotator cuffs from dealing with that. So I went from running every day, swimming every day, to full stop.
Now you came to know the Lord at 22. So all this time you knew the Lord. How's your relationship with the Lord growing?
Today or in general?
No, all through that.
2007 was a hard time because I was like, you know, things were going south health wise, and I thought, well, this isn't right. You know, I'd lost all the weight, and I was still exercising and doing everything, and then I ruptured this disc, and that was a very debilitating experience when you blow out a disc. I mean, I couldn't walk for a while. It was excruciatingly painful.
And was ruptured this. You'd lost the weight.
Way after, yeah, I was already in the service at this point. Oh, okay. So I was actually at that point. Let's see, I was 5 years in, but it did put the.
How did this damage occur?
Just wear and tear. It's just overuse, you know, they're overuse injuries. So I mean, when you have, I pronated on my feet, so the patellar tendonitis in my knees, it kind of trickles its way up. And unfortunately, like most of them, they don't tell you, when I'm in front of the orthopedic doctor, he looks at me and, you know, we learn these things the hard way when we're in front of the orthopedic doctor. Oh, don't do this, you need to do that, or you need this kind of shoe, or you need to, you know, change this or modify that. And I'm like, but the damage is done. The ship has sailed now. It's like, okay, I can't go back and undo the injury now that I know this. But, you know, that was kind of the disheartening time. So, and I thought, you know, at that point when I blew out the disc, I mean, things were really I got in a real season of bitterness because it was a real heavy blow. It ruined my career because it prevented me from doing certain requirements, physical fitness wise.
So that's why you retired after 10 years.
Right. That was a medical. Yeah. Originally, I got kicked after being overweight because I couldn't keep the weight off, and then there's for military standards that is, and then because I had so many surgeries that came out at that point, and I was on a profile. The budget cuts were coming down at that time. That was in 2011. So they were, they weren't honoring any waivers or anything like that. They were looking to cut any waiver they could. So unfortunately.
So is this when you started your mission work?
Mission work was I started in 2017.
So what led to that?
I was at a funeral for Kate's uncle, and one of her distant cousins comes up and says, you'd be a great missionary with my husband on his team in Zimbabwe. And I looked at this woman and I thought, who in the world are you? What in the world are you on? I just met her that day. And I'm like, where would you get that idea? That's ridiculous, And again, talk about being from the Lord. You knew it. You just knew. I knew.
Women haven't, the Bible says the fool does not confer with his wife. Women sometimes have a great sense and connect with, and male and female, actually, in the kingdom of God,
That's true. The spirit's going to use whatever tool, the most unsuspecting thing we would.
He's even been known to use a donkey if you read the Bible.
That's true. Very true. Yeah, she invited me to do that, or she made that the recommendation, and then I got in touch with her husband sometime later. But I had to go look where Zimbabwe was on the map because I didn't know where the heck that was at. Mm. I thought, but this is crazy, and so I go and I look into it, and it was, again, talk about being from the Lord. I just knew that it was the right thing to do. The first time I'd heard in my spiritual gifts assessment back in, it was 2002 or 2003, I had done that at the first church I was at. They told me I had the gift of missions then.
How would somebody know this? I mean, you're talking intuitively or word of knowledge or?
We did a spiritual gifts test. I can't remember who had written that. Sort of like a Myers-Briggs type of thing, except it was a spiritual gifts done.
I didn't even know something like that existed. Cool.
Well, then my pastor, Pastor Tom, says, Jason, you have the gift of missions. And he goes, and I can see that, because you have a way of relating to people. And I thought, missions? No, I couldn't be one of those. My mind went to, the way certain, Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door knocking, or, these Mormons would go around. All that stuff. Had a very negative
comment. Do you have a heart for those who have less opportunity than you? Would you say that?
That's definitely fair, yeah. Very much so.
Because I'm the same kind of guy that... I feel challenged in the world with normal people, but you give me this is an unpopular word now, a retarded or challenged person. You give me somebody who's has an inferiority, a certain segment that stands out. They could be very brilliant, but they could also have a deficit in another area. I tend to gravitate and be friends to, I tend to be a friend to the friendless, and there's some of us, and I think that's part of that calling.
Well, there is you want to bridge a gap that otherwise wouldn't be noticed because someone doesn't fit the norm.
Maybe it's because inside I feel like that a little bit, and
that could be an eccentricity, I suppose. I've got my own physics, and there's a certain dynamic of people that I get along with, and some I don't.
I think your wife gets a kick out of that.
Yeah, she definitely. She has
a proclivity for laughing, and now I know why.
Well, actually, we got married, and one thing I said, well, we'll never get bored, that's for sure. And I kind of said it tongue-in-cheek at the time, but I think she realized I was serious.
But isn't it great that she gets your sense of humor, and she gets that side of what is humorous, and keeps you light? They say the angels fly high because they take themselves lightly. I know, yuck, yuck, but it's, isn't there some truth in that?
That's true. I like it. It's been a perfect yin and yang, if you will.
Wonderful.
My wife's Kate.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We've had to learn the things that drew us together. If you're not careful, we focus on that. Kind of like that one aspect a person has that they're they're good at, or they excel in a given area. Focus on those things instead of the things that are the polar opposites that would drive us apart. And that's actually what makes us, it makes us stronger, and then helps us overcome challenges and things that we're dealing with.
The only thing is, when people get married, they say, I hate to go out, but he gets me to go out to restaurants and have fun. And then he says, I always just want to go, 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 and she gets me to stay at home and have home-cooked meals. Now it's 2 years later. Oh, he always wants to go out. Oh, all she wants to do is stay at home. So the very two things that attracted you now become a stumbling block.
They can be, but they don't have to be. I mean, it's, you know.
They certainly don't have to be.
In a way that, you know, Kate's balanced out my folly, if you will, to minimize the damage I can do, because I might, again, my sense of adventure is a little more liberal than hers, so I'm, you know, so I tend to take risks that can be a little bit careless.
It's a good thing she's willing to go along for the ride, right? Because you are kind of like the quintessential entrepreneur, right?
I guess, yeah, we,
what's he involved with now? Okay.
Well, she knows, it's never got boring. Yeah. So, and that's, there's probably some time that, you know, I think she wishes I could have scaled it back a little bit. On our honeymoon, it was about just shy of 3 weeks. I think we did 11 countries.
11 countries in 3 weeks? Wait, 3 times 7 is what? That's 21. You did sometimes you did more than one country in a day then.
In Europe it's not hard to not hard to do that, because I mean going from Belgium to Luxembourg to France into Germany from France, you're gonna cross 4 countries in 3 hours.
You sound like me. Like when I first got born again, I said, "Oh Lord, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this." He goes, Hey, do you want it all at once? This is why I've divided life up into days. Let me give you something now and save something for later. You go out to how many countries and oh, my word.
Well, we originally wanted to do one of those Danube flat-bottom river cruises, and I said that was going to be our, and where we would just be on the boat. I mean, and it went down the Danube and stopped all these little villages along the way and everything else. And the one that I wanted, and it was like $19,000 for the two of us. Cool. And I was like, that's a car payment. How about no? I'll rent a car, and we'll just do it ourselves in the car. And I liked, personally, as opposed to having a train ticket or something like that, yeah, the train's got its own advantages, but I like the fact that we could just pull off and stop in these little quaint villages all through Europe and just see our own thing, do our own thing on
our
own.
It's a college education. I went up the Baltic to 9 different nations one time on a cruise, and I tell you, I only had a high school diploma. So I didn't even have a high school diploma, excuse me, a ninth grade diploma. So I got a lot out of that.
I think our... the first 4 days in Paris, being on our feet, we were happy to get in the car for a while.
Yeah.
So I mean, we were our feet were killing us. And
you didn't drive a car in like England or something, where we're so used to driving on one side, it would be dangerous to drive on both sides, right?
I had a car in England. Yeah, we had a car. We've been to England. Well, Kate, I've been there, I think.
And you didn't have an accident, because you know.
No, I learned. I was actually wasn't hard to pick up. I would
you
say
must have great control of both sides of your brain.
I don't know about that. I'd to be a little bit more risky. I would say the most intimidating thing, I was in Ireland the first time I drove on the left, and what scared the living daylights out of me was I come up on a roundabout. Being from Pennsylvania, I would have called a traffic circle, the New Jersey traffic circles, we used to call those. And they were always...
Yeah, the confusion, because your subconscious is used to going one way or the other way, and my word.
The traffic is going, it's spinning the wrong way, and I'm like...
Oh, my word.
What in the world is that? And I'm looking at
what do I do?
Yeah, and then the other thing, you're not used to having 5 feet of car on the left side of you.
Yeah.
I'm used to having the...
Did you have any accidents or not?
I did smack my mirror on the passenger side, because I'm used to being closer to the curb.
Sure.
So, I hit the passenger side mirror one time, which didn't do any damage permanently, anything, nothing chipped off. But yeah, that was the one incident I had. Now, rule number one, I will never go without a GPS mirror. That one, I'm trying to read directions on the left side of the road, forget it. And a stick shift, too, on top of it. The other thing is that they did not reverse the clutch and the gas. All that's in the same order.
Did you visit any churches when you were there?
Oh, yeah. Lots of them.
He's laughing. There must be a story here.
Oh, yes. We were in, as far as churches, we did Notre Dame. We visited Le Mont Saint-Michel, which I thought was, the tide was in, so the road's underwater for a period of time, but we did get to see it at least, which is off the coast of Normandy Beach in Le Mont Saint-Michel in northern France.
Wow.
And then we did do Westminster Abbey when we were in England. That was a separate trip, but we did do that one. And then St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice. That was the highlight of the honeymoon. We were in Venice for a few days. And I remember being at the top of we could pay, I think, 1 or 2 euros to go up in the bell tower. And we're in the top of the bell tower, and I'm sitting there, and of course, a beautiful view of the city. I'm holding Kate. It's a very romantic setting. It was all just perfect, you know, and I'm looking out over the city, and you see all the gondolas and the canals and everything else. And I remember when we got up in the top, there was an old phone booth up there, and I looked behind us, and you could stand on this little platform that was maybe about a sidewalk's width between us, and then I could reach up and almost touch those bells. And the bells had to be a good 2 or 3 stories tall. These things were enormously huge. And I looked at Kate, I thought, and I think, I forget if Kate asked me, when do they ring these? And I said, oh, there's no way they ring these anymore. They would never let us in here this close to these things. And furthermore, you know, I said, if these things were 100 years old, they wouldn't dare risk ringing them. So I turn back around, and we're back overlooking the city, and I'm holding her, and it's very romantic. We're doing our cuddle time and all that. And sure enough, bong! And I'm like, oh, dear Lord, what in the world is happening? And they were ringing those bells. I mean, I could have smacked it with my hand. It was that close to me. And it was so loud. And I could feel my vertebrae in my back vibrating. And Kate's holding her eardrums, and she's looking at me like, you're insane. I was like, I'm not ringing the bell. I didn't know they would actually do this. And I didn't think they would let us up there if they were ringing these things. So she learned at that point not to trust my judgment to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, I mean, most of an American would not expect that. I didn't think. We would have thought, you know, there's too much liability to risk having people touristy around up there like that and ring the bell that close.
Did you two start in ministry together before the marriage, or did the ministry, the mission work, start after the marriage?
After.
Okay, what's the genesis of that?
That was so Kate's cousin invites me to recommends Zimbabwe. And I looked into it and I thought, you know, and that was one of those things I knew from the Lord, because I'm like, I did have the gift of missions and it didn't go away. And then when I finally signed up to do it, I remember, I was giddy as a schoolboy. I was so excited about this thing. And so I go on this trip, life-changing to say the least. Did all the fundraising, everything up to it. Then there's an invitation. They said that my church had caught wind that I had done knew that I went through this organization to do ministry in Zimbabwe. And they said, hey, do you want to go to the Ukraine? And initially, Kate and I had gone to a meeting for it. And I asked Kate if she minded me going. And then she says, you know, she said, no, I don't mind you going. And then as I'm driving back, I realized that they announced the dates for the Ukraine trip. I'm like, I can't go at the time. I had a commitment for business. I couldn't go at that time. And Kate says, I'd like to go. And surprised me. I thought you're going to go to the Ukraine without me. Okay. I mean, I was kind of mixed response. I was kind of surprised and shocked, and at the same time going, okay, are you serious? You want to do that? And she goes, I'd like to go. I was like, all right, more power to you. And then she went. I think you, Kate, you had a, they lost your luggage, I think, or something, or your bag showed up late. I forget. It was not a perfect trip, but you'd gone and you loved it, or you liked it.
Yes, I did.
And then, do you want to ask Kate?
I can't get her on here over.
Oh, too far away? Okay. So then the following, she says, you know, I'd love to go with the two of us together. I said, all right. So, and that was 2017 or 18, honey, I think. I lost track of the time.
I went in 2018 on that trip, and I want to back up a little bit. When he went to Zimbabwe, I was like, okay. I was feeling that that's just for gifted people. I'm not gifted in that. And then I remember, kind of talking with the Lord, saying, okay, well, there's maybe something with kids that maybe, you know, because I feel like I might be gifted with that. And so with that first meeting that we went to, it was all about children. So that's when
this is in Ukraine.
For the Ukraine trip.
Wow. What did you do with the children?
We did different kind of games and activities with them. We did like what's called the Salvation Bracelets. It's just, you know, tells the story of Jesus and coming to the Lord with that. And we did that, and we did games and stories and all kinds of things with that.
How did you like the culture? Now, this is obviously before the war. How did you like the culture over there? And has that experience, of course, having connected with these people, you must be fervently praying for them now that they're being killed mercilessly by the Russians.
Yes, it's hard to watch. It's I remember the friendliest interpreters that we had and that I still keep in touch with today. And you feel bad for them, but when you actually personally know them, it's kind of, it makes it, you know, more personal.
Now, you ended up going back with her to Ukraine, or?
Yes, the second trip to that she went in 2019, we both went together. I actually, met me, I was finishing a Zimbabwe trip. Then we had rendezvoused in London. And Kate had come out the latter half of that, and then we met up, and we went to Kiev together from there.
Now, who sets this up? Is there a church? You did this on your own? Or
The Zimbabwe trip was set up through E3 Partners. That's the organization that handles the church planning ministry there.
But Ukraine?
The Ukraine was done through Calvary Chapel, Melbourne.
Okay. Calvary Chapel in Melbourne, Florida.
Yeah.
So how does that work? I mean, the pastor says we have need of a missionary there. Would you guys want to go?
They usually, the trips are organized at the church level. They have, they assemble the teams there.
Short term, long term?
These are short term, 2 weeks, maybe three sometimes.
And what did you accomplish when you were there? Did you preach on the streets? Did you help build a church? Or
We actually built a church. We renovated their church. They actually have a, they had gotten a building, Calvary Chapel in Poltava. And then the bottom, the upstairs, I think was a, honey, was it a store or a,
I can't remember what it was.
But are they poor there? Is it a third world nation?
I think
Ukraine.
I would say it's a little stark. Not necessarily. I wouldn't call it a third world. I would call it second world. People have regular amenities that we're used to. Some of them look simpler, but they're you'll go inside of an apartment, what they call a flat. And I mean, everything's as luxurious as you'd think. Stainless steel appliances, nice big screen TV,
really?
And hardwood floors. I mean, the whole nine.
Were there homes or just like when I went into Moscow, it was all apartments. These big ugly concrete buildings, not even done fashionably, no color to them.
Right. And that's they call them flats. Because interestingly enough, when you rent the space, you just get the space. So anything you do to that, whether you put your own light fixtures and your own bathrooms and everything
really?
Yourself, yeah, that's yours. So you actually just get the space, the whole.
Really?
And which is usually just like I call it Stalin gray.
Stalin gray. Yeah. What did you accomplish when
we
you
had remodeled the church? They had given them the basement of this building to have the church in, and so we remodeled it. We put all new new walls on, drywall. Redid the bathrooms, gave it all new surfacing, so it was nice and clean.
How was the language? Did you have to learn some of it?
We had learned a little bit, but we had interpreters as well. Mm-hmm. They did provide us with their own interpreters.
I like the challenge of having to learn, when in Rome do as the Romans and all that,
But I'll tell you the struggle I have, when going through an interpreter, as you've gathered, I talk fast, and it forces me to slow down.
Yes.
Especially when I'm trying to minister and teach. That trip to Zimbabwe in particular, I was teaching a sermon on, or actually a course, if you will, on praying spiritual intimacy with your wife. And it was called Just Say the Word. And what it was, it's basically talking about spiritual intimacy just between the husband and wife vertically, praying.
Really? I want to hear more. We'll have to do another interview for this sometime.
Okay, well,
I'm very intrigued with prayer because remember we had the conjoined twins about 15 years ago? The whole world's praying for them, the two girls that were attached. The surgeons went in, they died. So I'm thinking, well, Lord, if we had the whole world praying, what good is prayer? And then I thought, well, is prayer a vehicle to manipulate God or to tell him your way? So obviously prayer is not to manipulate God. So I go, well, what is prayer?
That's I said, no, it's not to manipulate God, that's for sure. So if I go to the Lord and say, God, I need $1 million. Or, well, he said, well, no, you don't. And if I say, well, I want $1 million, he goes, I'm sure you do, but you're not getting it. And for good reason. He knows darn well if I had too much money and was I would get very lazy, I'd have no motivation.
I wanted to be a famous country star, and I even won first place in Nashville's Music City Song Festival. Had I become famous, I'd probably be dead now. I reach now favor sometimes is when he says, no, a small life where the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker is better than having too much,
Brother?
I had an experience the first time I went to the Ukraine. We did go out like in about threes and like fours groups out and about in the community, and we prayed with them. And I was against it. I was nervous about praying with them, but the guy I was with, and we talked to one of the grandmas that were out, and she said the prayer. She came to the Lord.
Oh, that's got to be marvelous.
And we were the only group that that happened with, so that was kind of a godly moment.
It's pretty cool when somebody comes to know the Lord because of your presence somewhere.
Yes.
That's true. I've never come across folks that usually, if someone's not interested, they kind of just, they'll just say so. I rarely had that happen. If I talked to somebody on the street in Zimbabwe, especially, they were so happy to have someone pray with them and
really?
so encouraged by it. Mm. One home, the lady said, I saw your group and you didn't come here. And we went down a different street the day before. And she said, I said, there's people praying for you now in America. They know we're on this mission trip. There are other people in our church there and they know that we're here to help. And she burst into tears. And I thought, okay, he said, why was that so shocking? She goes, I thought the world forgot about Zimbabwe. And I thought, you know, well, is that really, I mean, I can see where they got that perception. And I encouraged her. And I just said, ma'am, of course people pray, people care. And every church knows there's other churches and countries that are not as privileged as some are.
So did you spend some quality time with her?
Yeah, we did. We got into, did some reading in the, with Luke, and I forget exactly which chapter, but I spent just some time in the Word with her. There was a team of us there, and then she had invited some of her neighbors and her kids to come over.
Now, you are retired from the military, but you run a business called Argo, right?
Yes.
But you do this missionary stuff. With what frequency do you do this? Is this a part-time thing, or?
Well, prior to COVID, we were going twice a year, and then the plan was to increase that to, it would have been, yeah, we're going to keep it going twice a year. Either to, I was going to take Kate to Zimbabwe because she hadn't been yet, and I wanted to get her more exposed to where she can get some curriculums of her own together. Kate's very gifted with the children, and I really, that there's a place where it's a little more flexible.
Sure.
Not necessarily with a church, because Calvary Chapel had a system, but because there was a church already there.
So are you going through Calvary Chapel here now, or what church do you attend in Vero Beach, Florida?
We still go to Calvary Chapel in Sebastian.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, that's where we both worship. But as far as going back to the mission field, I wanted Kate to have an experience with an actual mission organization, because she has a lot more hands-on control on what she can do with the kids, and it's going to open more opportunities. And I thought, you know, one thing I like about mission work, we should be fulfilled in doing it. And that means, so we, each one of us has our own gifts, our spiritual gifts, our talents, our skills, things that we can, you know, that we contribute to the kingdom. Each one of us is, you know, one part, many, many branches.
There was the missionary who said, he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. So it's funny, we do things to make a living, to make money, to get ahead, and yet all that will probably be burned up in the fire. But the things that have eternal, you know, store up treasure where moth and rust doth not corrupt. Didn't Jesus say that?
Yes. Store up for yourself treasures in heaven where, or not on earth where moth and thieves destroy. Build up treasures in heaven. Oh. And that's in Luke as well, I'm pretty sure. Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you the exact citation. I'm trying to get better at that, scripture memory. But
you don't need to know the location. Just as long as I go, it's in there.
It is. It is. You know, to me, that's when you're fulfilled. Again, it's nothing's work when you're enjoying it, and when it's that rewarding to you. You know, and then to me, there's no greater satisfaction than you're employing your skills. You're doing something that's good, and the reward you get from serving the mission field, serving the kingdom, versus a paycheck. It's a totally different ballgame.
Did you get any confirmation when you went, whether it's circumstantial, they call it God incidents as opposed to coincidence, did you see any miracles?
I would have to say the closest to a miracle I saw was an exorcism.
Really?
Yeah.
Where was this, in Africa?
In Africa, yes. And I remember that at first it intimidated me and then kind of scared me, and then at the same time I never thought I would see that in real life. I thought that only happened in Hollywood, to be honest.
What were the circumstances that led up to that?
This gal had apparently been given some kind of some drugs from a witch doctor or something, and I guess they I don't know what was in it. So she was ill, but I don't know, there was some background story, but she's sitting there, her eyes are rolled back into her head, she's chanting over and over again.
Hmm.
And they called me to this village outside, a little remote place, and they brought two of the elders that had wanted to come with me, and someone had asked for us to please come. This girl needs help. There's something wrong, and she might have been 14 or 15 years old. And I get in there, and they had her laying down. She's clearly not. She's either under the influence of something. I don't know if even some kind of drug. There is some things that like some voodoo stuff that still gets practiced in those parts of the world, and also. You know, they have witch doctors that give them some kind of herbal concoctions that might have some hallucinogenic effects or something. So I immediately just opened, I opened the book of Matthew, and I just started reading the gospel. We all started going to prayer, and then, as I'm sitting there, she's grabbing my arm, grabbing my shirt, yanking. She's trembling. I mean, this girl, like, she starts going through, it looked like an kind of epileptic seizure. I mean, she was going into this convulsions and all this stuff, and she's, and clearly, and I just kept on reading. I just kept on reading, and I went through, and I think I got through a good, in the middle of chapter 4. And reading in a prayerful sense, you know, not just word for word, and she finally, and then she, it all, everything just stops quiet. And she's laying there, and I set her down, and she's unconscious at this point, not responding to anything or anyone. And, we had left shortly thereafter. We prayed with the family and encouraged them, let her rest.
Mm.
The next day, she was completely coherent. Life was normal. And, you know, she wakes up. It's herself. Her eyes are there, present. Now, she recognized me when I walked up to the house. And she had never, well, prior to it being, she'd not seen me the day before. At least her eyes were not coherent. They were rolled back in her head. I don't know how she remembered me, but she remembered me.
Well, you know, well, it's important, I have a friend who had a visitation before he came to know the Lord, and or he's just come to know the Lord, and his former, I guess, friend or girlfriend was just looked across the table, and this big, deep voice said, "I will never give her up." And later on, she didn't even remember it, and he ended up ending that relationship. I hope the lady got freed, but the only reason I don't even like giving glory to that guy, but the thing is, Paul said we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities of light and darkness, and I think we need to be aware of that. Okay, we're about out of time for today, so I'll talk to you in the future. By the way, your name is?
Jason Conklin.
And if people want to find out about your business, which is Argo, and that is under the, what is it all about?
For environmental development, jason@argosciences.com.
Okay. And also a part-time missionary. You and your wife go away a couple times a year. Where are you heading off to next?
Well, we hope to go back to Zimbabwe in September.
Wonderful. Yes. That'd be wonderful. Well, listen, so if you have 30 seconds to lead somebody to the Lord, what would you say to them?
30 seconds to lead someone to the Lord. Just ask, do you know Jesus? And most people will say yes or no. You know, they'll answer. And offer to pray with them. And okay. Say, how could I pray for you today?
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to your missus here.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay. Thank you. God bless you both. Thanks for coming on the show. And I'm Rhett Palmer.
I am available. just because I'm not black and blue doesn't mean I haven't been abused. I've been held up to be thrown across the room with words of steel, words of steel. Been so ashamed.